This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Green light 3-0 and she's gone!
Welcome to the 3-0 Show, part of the Athletic Baseball Show. It is Thursday, August 11th. Derek Van Riper, Eno Saris, and Katie Wu joining us. Katie, of course, covers the Cardinals for The Athletic. Katie, thanks for stepping in.
Guys, thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to join in here with you guys.
Timing is perfect. We're going to talk about the NL Central today anyway, and the Cardinals, team you cover, right in the thick of things with the Brewers, and I think that division race has impacts on the wild card battle in the NL, so we're going to dig into that. We're going to talk about a few key injuries on the American League side that could shape the playoff picture there. And a question that I never thought we would ask on this podcast a few months ago, could the Orioles actually win more games than the Red Sox this year? Because it looks like that is a possibility, and that's not something I thought I'd be saying in August of 2022. But let's get underway with the NL Central shift. Seems like momentum has really changed the last week or so. The Cardinals swept the Yankees last weekend, and that was on the heels of a surprising deadline day swap that sent Harrison Bader to the Bronx for Jordan Montgomery. And Katie, as we enter play on Wednesday, the Cards have won 7 of their last 8, while the Brewers have really stumbled. And for the second time this season, the Cardinals have higher playoff odds than the Brewers. So what's been the difference lately? What's making this team click?
I think there are a multitude of factors making the Cardinals click at the right time. One goes to, I think the most obvious is their trade deadline acquisitions. The Cardinals' weakest asset all season long has been their lack of starting pitching. And when you think of how they opened the season, their entire rotation was banking on pitchers coming back from significant injuries. In certain cases, like Miles Michaelis, betting on him, that worked out. In other cases, betting on Jack Flaherty, that did not. So when you look at a Cardinals team that has a much more improved offense, their defense is always going to be stellar. They have that same kind of proper veteran leadership that you've come to expect from guys like Adam Wainwright, Yadier Molina, and now Albert Pujols. It was always the starting pitching that was the question. So what do they do? Even though they were pretty heavily involved up until the last couple days in the Juan Soto sweepstakes, president of baseball operations, John Mozeliak, ultimately opted to do the obvious and boost the rotation. Cardinals got two lefties in Jose Quintana and Jordan Montgomery, and I think that really stabilized the clubhouse. I'll read what Ollie Marmol said, their manager, after their first game after the trade deadline and what it meant to acquire the right pieces at the right time. And I thought what he said was pretty pointed and pretty clear on how obvious it was to make these acquisitions. He was asked the importance of adding key pieces at the deadline, and he said, "It's meaningful. It really is, because the club is sitting there and you've identified what's needed. Then you go get the pieces, and you don't just get the pieces, but you get the right pieces. How they fit personality-wise in that clubhouse and their skill set, that's just going to add a ton of value to what we're doing. We didn't go get guys just to get guys. We got the right guys." And I think the Cardinals can certainly feel that. Quintana is an 11-year veteran, has spent most of his years in the NL Central. Jordan Montgomery really profiles the type of starting pitcher they needed. They needed a guy with a lot of swing and miss. He's a left-handed sinkerball guy, very low walk rate. Those are all traits the Cardinals covet. So I think those deadline acquisitions really helped ease the nerves of a Cardinals team that very much finds itself in division contention, but needed some assurance along the way. I also don't think we can rule out the presence of Yadier Molina returning and what he did to that clubhouse. He was out for 6 weeks with right knee inflammation. And you ask any guys on the team, Nolan Arenado, Tyler O'Neill, Jose Quintana, they've all said Yadi coming back, just his presence, just the factor that he has in that clubhouse, that means everything to them. So two pieces coming along right at the same time. Yadi did make he did come back off the IL the same day as the trade deadline, and the Cardinals really haven't looked back since.
Yeah, teams always love to activate a player from the IL on or around deadline day, and it certainly makes a pretty big difference when that player is Yadier Molina, given the impact he has around that clubhouse. You know, as you think about the adjustments that the Cardinals made at the deadline and the surprising Josh Hader trade the Brewers made at the deadline, we've talked about these two teams, we stacked them up a couple of times. What separates them right now? What's going to be the potential difference between them over these final 2 months? They continue to jockey for that top spot in the NL Central.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. If you look at the depth charts on Fangraphs, they have this one page where you can look at the totals. And you can kind of, in fact, if you sort by totals, the Brewers and Cardinals are almost in a virtual tie. So you can actually see the teams right next to each other. And you can see, of course, you know, first base and third base go to the Cardinals. And generally, what's interesting about these two teams and how they match up is the Cardinals are two wins better with the bats, and the Brewers are two wins better with the arms, you know? And that I think that actually still sums up pretty well how different these teams are. If the Brewers are going to win, it's because a guy like Willy Adames gets hot. You know, one of their Rowdy Tellez, one of their bats that's pretty good, kind of gets into another level and kind of helps carry this team. We're all waiting for Christian Yelich to kind of find that level again. But, you know, they have a bunch of pretty good bats that could go to the next level and carry this team. And I think if we're looking for the Cardinals to have the same thing, we're looking for an arm to do that. And I think, you know, like I think Wainwright, he can put, you know, pull off a stretch anytime. Michaelis has shown the ability, obviously, the last start. I'm just going to say Coors. I don't think that's like a referendum on Miles Michaelis. It's one of the worst Coors starts I've seen in a while. It's like two and a third and 10 runs, but you know, still Coors, but Miles Michaelis can do that, and I think Jordan Montgomery can do that. And it's interesting to think about Molina, because a lot of people who thought he was overrated and there were people who were strict numbers, people who said there's no way he's a Hall of Famer. And then Fangraphs said, "Oh, you know, we put framing into WAR now, and oh, look, Molina's a Hall of Famer." So I, you know, especially with catchers, if people tell me they're a Hall of Famer and they smell like a Hall of Famer and they've had a career that kind of looks like a Hall of Famer, I'm more likely to say that's probably true, because I think there's one element we haven't put in WAR yet, which I think Molina might be really good at, which is game calling. And that's really impossible to put a number on, but I bet you watching these games, Katie, have seen moments where he's just called a brilliant pitch, or, you know, notice he doesn't get shaked off much, or, you know, something along those lines. Because if you look at the types of players pitchers they acquire, they didn't get, you know, guys who are two pitch pitchers with high stuff that are, you know, maybe more volatile, or they got pitchers with a lot of pitches. You know, and I think, you know, that's something that plays to Molina's strengths. If he can be really good at game calling and they have a lot of pitches, he can dance around whatever strengths the hitters have, since he knows that so well. So, you know, I think that, you know, in combination, that the types of, when they say right players, you could think, you know, sort of veteran, you know, won't shake up the clubhouse in terms of personality, but you could also think command, lots of pitches, fits with our catcher, that sort of deal, and doesn't cost as much. I mean, you could have gotten Luis Castillo, but it would have cost Jordan Walker and you know, more, maybe a Yepes and more. I mean, the package that the Reds got for Castillo was pretty impressive. So you know, I think these teams are both interesting because they're flawed in very different ways. They have strengths in other ways, and it's going to be somebody getting hot. Like, it doesn't usually come down to one or two players. It's usually a whole team thing. But really, one or two players could change this division, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I could see Jack Flaherty, if he's back after what should be a pretty lengthy rehab assignment, if he's anything close to the pitcher he's been when healthy in the past, that's a massive lift for the Cardinals, not only down the stretch, but potentially in the playoffs too. Because when I look at this team, the only real weakness I see is that compared to other playoff teams, especially the top tier playoff teams, I think the Cardinals are giving something up in most starting pitching matchups. When you compare them to the Mets, when you compare them to the Braves, the Dodgers, the Mets, the Padres, the Brewers.
Compared to the Grom and Scherzer?
But every other playoff contender, yeah. I think every other playoff contender in the NL probably has an edge on the Cardinals in terms of the quality of their rotation, even if the Cardinals get more mileage out of their starters. And I think that's part of what makes Flaherty so important. I mean, Katie, are we at the point now, Flaherty's supposed to start a rehab assignment on Wednesday. It might even be happening as we're recording. I didn't check to see what time that game was starting. But are we at the point now where it's reasonable to expect him to at least make a handful of starts down the stretch, given the timing of when he's beginning this assignment?
Absolutely. I mean, I can understand fans' trepidation when you think about the season that Jack Flaherty has had, and really dating back to 2021. It's the issues that he's had have spiraled from a freak accident swinging a bat. But what Jack Flaherty is, the plan for him now is just to have this rehab assignment on Wednesday. He's eligible to come off the 60-day IL on August 26th. four rehab starts in Memphis would have him able to start in Cincinnati on August 29th, 30th, or 31st, whatever lines up with that rotation. And the plan all along has been for him to return as a starter. And if you get a healthy, dominant Jack Flaherty back, I mean, I know it has been a while since he's dominated the National League, but when you look at his stuff, his potential, his ability to perform, I mean, that is getting a huge boost in the arm right there in September in the most pivotal time. He was always going to come back as a starter. There was no question about that. And I think when you have a rotation that then looks like Adam Wainwright, Jack Flaherty, Miles Michaelis, Jordan Montgomery, Jose Quintana, I mean, that, I think, really boosts your overall playoff odds and your playoff makeup. As you guys have pointed out, you know, the Cardinals don't have a Jacob deGrom or a Max Scherzer or a both if you're the New York Mets on their rotation. But getting Jack Flaherty back certainly puts that star aspect back that all playoff teams need to have. You need to have an ace caliber star pitcher. You can make the argument that's Adam Wainwright, but really, if all things are sitting on all cylinders for the Cardinals, it's Jack Flaherty. So him having a really solid August, rehabbing, not rushing through anything, sticking to their plan is going to be super imperative for this club come September.
Was there some disagreement between the team and the pitcher on his last, you know, go through? What, did he want to be activated before the team or something? Like, why? How did that happen that he came up and then had the soreness so quick?
I mean, it was very tricky, right? Because the Cardinals had been so insular and so quiet about their plan for Jack, and they had really stuck to a very strict timetable. And all of a sudden, after two rehab assignments, it was, okay, well, he's going to start a game for us and build up the intensity there. And, you know, I've talked to both sides, and they were very adamant that they were both in an agreement that it would serve Jack better to build up intensity-wise at the major league level than it would be in AAA, just based on the talent and based on the level of intensity he's accustomed to when he pitches. Now, obviously, it's very unfortunate how that played out.
It seems a little different this time, though, too, right? You're talking about four rehab starts.
Does seem a little different. Obviously, didn't really turn out well. Those three starts, not good, and then had a shoulder strain. But, you know, Jack said that could happen at any time. That could happen during my rehab assignment. But now, since he's not even eligible to come off the 60-day IL until August 26th, I think that they feel more comfortable in doing the full rehab assignment. No shortcuts. Stick to the plan and really, honestly, hope for the best from there. Because like we've talked about, a Cardinals team with a healthy Jack Flaherty in September is a completely different team.
I also think Jordan Montgomery might be a little underrated when you consider how difficult it is to pitch in Yankee Stadium, how hitter-friendly that ballpark is, and getting him out of there and into St. Louis is a pretty big upgrade for him. So maybe he ends up being their third-best starter. Maybe he ends up being really important once you get down to your playoff rotation. Katie, did it feel like the Cardinals really salvaged the deadline by getting Montgomery in that last-second swap? Because it seemed to me from afar that Cardinals fans were, well, for lack of a better word, just pissed about what was happening up to that point.
Never.
Yeah, my emails, my Twitter DMs, they would tend to agree with you. But look, I think Cardinals fans, when news first broke that they had traded Harrison Bader for Jordan Montgomery, there was a lot of backlash because Harrison Bader is such a beloved fan favorite. And he's one of the best defensive center fielders in the game for a team that really benefits from defense and prides itself with its defensive ability. It didn't really make any sense from a fan's perspective on why they would give up one of their fan favorites for a pitcher they'd never heard of. Now, really, the reason why fans weren't targeted on Jordan Montgomery is because Jordan Montgomery wasn't really on anyone's radar when it came to guys that could have been traded. But when you look at how he profiles, I mean, he's a left-handed sinkerball pitcher. That's a trait the Cardinals obviously covet. Look, they signed Steven Matz for 4 years and $44 million on the premise that he was a left-handed sinkerball pitcher. But we'll look at some of the traits that President of Baseball Operations John Mozeliak really likes when he identifies starters. The chase rate that in Jordan Montgomery ranks in the 80th percentile, his whiff percentage, 74th percentile, his hard hit percentage, 75th percentile. This is a Cardinals rotation that really doesn't have a lot of swing and miss. It really doesn't. They're all pitch for contact kind of guys. That works when you pitch at Busch Stadium and you have Nolan Arenado and Paul Goldschmidt on the corners and an all-around stellar defense behind you. But another thing about Jordan Montgomery, his walk percentage is in the 91st percentile. This is a guy that's always in the zone. His ground ball rate, nearly 50%. That's a career high. These are all traits that the Cardinals really go out and identify. You pair him with, again, Yadier Molina's presence behind the mound, his game calling, his pitch framing, and I think you have a much better quality starting pitcher than the stats at Yankee Stadium would show. And I think that acquisition really solidified the belief in the clubhouse that, okay, this is a front office that is going to push us all in to win the division. They're tired of winning the wild card. Nolan Arenado has said it multiple times. He's never won a division. He'd like to be a part of one. And I think that move really solidified, as tough as it was to lose Harrison, I've really solidified to the rotation into the clubhouse that this front office sees the importance in winning the division.
You know, believe it or not, the numbers actually sort of bear out the Cardinals' approach more than the Brewers' approach in terms of what happens in the postseason. You know, I think there's a lot of adages where people say, oh, defense, pitching, aces, win in the postseason. All the research I've done suggests that, if anything, hitting is slightly more more important in the postseason. There's no correlation between, you know, the strength of your aces or the strength of your pitching staff and how many postseason games you win, at least. And so this is the team, the Cardinals team, that says, you know, we get to the postseason, Adam Wainwright could still spin us seven innings with one hit. It's still in there, you know, because he's got that amazing curveball. And if he just, you know, keeps them dancing around that with the other pitches, you know, he can still do it. And I think that they basically, you know, got that almost that lottery approach with the starters, where it's like, hey, these guys, any of these guys could pitch us six, seven strong innings in a postseason. It doesn't necessarily look like they will when you put them up against Scherzer and DeGrom at the top, or Burns and you know, Peralta or whatever. Like, it doesn't, you know, it's not obvious that they could do it. But you think about what happens in the postseason. There's always like this, oh, Miles Michaelis just threw, you know, six no-hit innings. Like, yeah, of course, that happens, you know? And so, you know, the Cardinals, I think, are a more dangerous team than people give them credit for when they look at that starting staff.
I wonder, are both of the NL Central teams better equipped for the postseason than people realize? The difference between the Cardinals offense and the Brewers offense, I do think the Cardinals offense is a little bit better. WRC plus so far bears that out. They're at 109 for the season. Brewers are at 106. That's a pretty small difference. But the key difference in how they manufacture their runs, the Brewers strike out more. That was a problem for the Brewers
in the past season. And that's meaningful in the postseason. Too. That's more meaningful in the postseason.
And the Cardinals, you know, putting more balls in play, they have a strikeout rate 20.5%. That's in line with Toronto. It's closer to what the Mets are doing at 19.7%. Houston just below 20%. So even if they don't do quite as much damage with the long ball as some of the other teams ahead of them in terms of overall offensive production, I do think that makes the Cardinals a peskier lineup to deal with in the postseason.
Wait, are you picking against the Brewers in the division?
No. I'm not making a pick. I'm waffling. Here's one other thing that's changed for me. I have finally given up hope that Christian Yelich, the MVP version, walks back through the door, right? Any player can get hot for a stretch. Any player can play like an MVP for a few weeks or even a couple of months. And I think he's still a very good player. But the guy we saw, you know, pre-2020 in Milwaukee, I don't think we're going to see him again. So I think it will fall on other players in this lineup. Willy Adames might be their best offensive player right now. Hunter Renfroe might be a more dangerous power hitter than Christian Yelich at this point. It's going to come down to guys like Urias, Tellez, some of those secondary players. And how much do you trust those guys compared to the other guys that the Cardinals are leaning on behind their star power, right? So they match up really well.
Is there a Cardinal that kind of fits that bill too for you, Katie? That's like kind of like the Rowdy Tellez or you know, Hunter Renfroe, like somebody that's that could step forward and be a big difference for them coming up. Is it, you know, a middle reliever or one of their outfielders that you know, I really like what Lars Nootbaar has been doing recently, you know, and he could be important for them, especially if Yepes's injury continues to affect him.
Yeah, I mean, when you were thinking that, I was instantly thinking Lars Nootbaar. I was thinking, you know, maybe Dylan Carlson, long-term starting center fielder of the future for the Cardinals. But really, the name that pops out to me is Paul DeJong. I mean, this is a former all-star shortstop that was optioned to the minors in May. I mean, he was hitting 130 with a 417 OPS, one homer in 24 games at the time of his option. So that makes sense. But very rarely do you see a clubhouse favorite, a guy with just under 5 years of service time, option to the minors with the, like, a clear assignment of, you're not coming back up for a while. You're not coming back up until you are right. So get right. And to Paul's credit, that's what he did. For 2 months, he was down in AAA, really embraced the minor league lifestyle again. That is so difficult to do when you're accustomed to the luxuries of major leagues, right? And it wasn't like, and this is what everyone in the organization has been saying, it wasn't like he went to Memphis for a week and said, okay, I feel good. When am I coming back up?
Right.
He never checked in once. He said, they'll call when they'll call. And he worked and he got his swing right. He got his mind right. Since coming back, coming into play on August 10th, he is hitting 250, which, okay, fine. But four of his seven hits have been home runs. The other three have been doubles. He's driven in 12 and he has an OPS of 1.175. Now, this looks a lot like the Paul DeJong the Cardinals were hoping for. He's never been a player that profiles hit for average. Even in his All-Star season, he was hitting around 235, 240. But he is one that hits for power, and he does play, the Cardinals think, the best shortstop, and they believe they have their best infield when he is their starting shortstop.
And they traded
so he can continue
away,
this trend. So. Exactly. They're kind of like, it's all, the writing's on the wall, right? They're firmly believing that Paul DeJong helps to carry this team going forward, and I think he's going to play a pivotal role.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what happens with him over these final 2 months, because as you said, since coming back, he's looked more like that guy he was a couple of seasons ago, and that's huge. Plus, having a healthy Tyler O'Neill could also give them another boost just in terms of the overall production from this lineup. Seven more games between the Brewers and Cardinals before the end of the season. Five of those actually take place in St. Louis. We got a series coming up starting on Friday in St. Louis. We got a mid-September two-gamer in St. Louis before a very late September two-game series in Milwaukee.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Let's move over to the rest of the NL wildcard picture. It just seems like the Dodgers and Mets are really well positioned right now atop their respective divisions. Nothing, of course, set in stone, but that leaves the runner-up of this NL Central battle in a big race against the Braves, the Padres, and the Phillies. You know, as you look at these teams now, everyone's on the Padres, of course, because of their really aggressive trade deadline, and they finally had a pretty big win with a walk-off from Manny Machado on Tuesday night. Who actually gets left out when you start looking at these wild card contenders?
Yikes. By the playoff percentages, the Brewers right now. At the same time, you'd think that there would be enough patty cake games on a central schedule. And I don't have the Brewers and Cardinals in front of me, but they've got to be playing the Pirates some. The Reds are worse now than they were before. The Cubs sold. You'd think that the strength of schedule would favor the Brewers over the Phillies. And, Fangraphs says that's the case, but still gives the Phillies about 14% more percentage points, more of a chance to make it. I don't know. It's the ghost of Britt in me. shout out to Britt, who had her beautiful baby boy. I look at that bullpen that the Phillies got, and they did get a little better at the deadline, but it's the kind of the hair up the nose kind of bullpen where none of them really have any good command other than Robertson. And I look at that defense, and the news out of Philadelphia is that Harper has stopped throwing, and so he's not going to play in the field, which means... is Derek Hall staying with the team as an outfielder? You know what I mean? Like, there's kind of too many first base DH types in Philadelphia for me. Maybe Brandon Marsh, solidifies center for them. And maybe releasing Didi Gregorius was important for their defense. But, defense and bullpen, that's an easy way for a team that's projected to win to not win. And that's sort of where I'm looking for the Phillies versus the Brewers. So the Brewers did make their bullpen a little bit worse, and the Brewers don't have amazing defense at every spot, but I think they're pretty solid everywhere. At least in that sort of a matchup, I'll take the Brewers over the Phillies.
What do you think, Katie?
You know, I've said all season long, there's no guarantee if you don't win the NL Central that you make the playoffs, just when you look at the rest of the National League and the field. But when you also look at the NL East, I mean, that's a pretty lethal division. You have the Mets, you have the Braves. Braves are way too talented to not make the postseason. They're going to be in it. When you look at the Padres, Padres should be in it. They have the talent. They spent the money, which they deserve all the credit in the world for spending the money to be competitive. They just have to figure out their Dodger problem. That's a glaring problem that they do have. So when you're looking at it, for me, it also comes down to the Brewers and the Phillies, or, you know, the Cardinals and the Phillies, should they not win the division. I think that's why St. Louis feels so strongly they need to win the division so they can eliminate any possible outlying chance. Although I will say, if you're going to bet on a team to strangely, weirdly get hot without explanation, win 17 games in a row, I don't know, in September, you know, maybe bet on the Cardinals. But I think that's what makes the race between the Cardinals, the Brewers, and the Phillies so interesting, is you almost have to win the division to just kind of get that pressure off your back. Because I don't think, again, if you win the Central, or if you don't win the Central, that you make the playoffs. Now, I'm all in on seeing stellar defense every day. If you don't have a good defense, I find it really hard for you to consistently win ball games, which is why I'm a little concerned about Philadelphia. At the same time, the Brewers didn't get better at the deadline. They got worse. And that also plays directly into morale. I mean, look at the two tailspins the Cardinals and the Brewers have been on in opposite directions since the deadline. So the way I'm looking at it, I mean, you can also argue strength of schedule that in the NL Central, NL East, the Phillies got to go against some tough teams consistently. NL Central, Cardinals and Brewers just go against each other, and then they can beat up on the rest of the teams, kind of pad their record. I'm looking at the Cardinals schedule on my wall right here. Looks pretty breezy up until 1 week in September when they play the Padres, Dodgers, and Brewers right before the end of the season. That's going to be some must-watch television right there. But I do think it's going to come down between whoever doesn't win the NL Central and the Phillies on the odd one out.
Yeah, the Brewers have a 492 strength of schedule the rest of the way. Cardinals at 472, Phillies at 499. So a slightly tougher path for the Phillies and a little bit of an
Those
easier one for the Cardinals.
The Braves and Mets, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pretty big difference when you start to think about that over what's left of this season. I have a question about Josh Hader specifically. Is there something actually wrong? You know, Sports Info Solutions had a post that went up a few weeks ago about Hader's release point being different. And even though from the basic look at his velocity and his pitch mix, things otherwise seem mostly the same, is this a simple correctable thing? Or did the Brewers see something that they thought was more problematic? Could this be a bit of an explanation as to why they were willing to risk making a trade like they did? I mean, we saw Hader struggle in the game that the Padres won on Tuesday night. He had a 4-1 lead, first save opportunity, enabled the tying runs to cross the plate, eventually got bailed out with that Machado 3-run walk-off. What do you make of the Hader struggles? Is it just even a great closer can go through a stretch like this, or is there something fundamentally different about him?
Well, his release point has been creeping up, and it's not so much that it's done so much movement this year. This year, it's moved a matter of inches, but over his career, we're now talking about it having moved a third of a foot, so 4 or 5 inches, getting close to a half foot in terms of the difference in his release point. And that's, you know, even though his movement hasn't changed as much, it speaks to his deception, because the whole reason that Josh Hader is deceptive is he has a very low release point, and yet he still gets good vertical movement. And so if that release point starts drifting upwards, then the correlation between his, like, you know, his vertical movement profile and his release point becomes easier for hitters to understand. Plus, you know, there's this thing about just seeing a guy over and over again. You know, there's some discussion about Tyler Rogers and whether or not he is like a trick pitcher that works if you haven't seen him. And I could see some of that. I could understand some of that, because he throws basically like submarine style with these sliders that kind of rise, and he throws like a slider up in the zone, and it's just all backwards. But if you just see him, then you just recalibrate and you say, okay, the slider he throws up and the fastball he throws down, and this is what they look like, and I've seen him before, and Manny Machado walk-off homer. So, you know, I wonder if maybe Hader will have better days going forward, just based on the fact that he's now facing some opponents that haven't seen him as much. I wonder if the opponents that have seen him a lot are more used to him now. And I wonder if he's lost a little deception based on that moving release point. But watching the game last night that he kind of almost blew, it was command. You know, he just couldn't find the zone. There weren't a lot of hard hits or anything. It was just a bunch of walks. And that's just something that comes and goes. It's something that has to do with really minor things like maybe a drifting release point or a hamstring or something that, you know, that's not reported, some smaller nagging injury that can affect your command. Maybe just fatigue. So, you know, I don't have an answer for you that, you know, that Hader is, I wouldn't say that looking at the numbers, Hader is bad. But I think there's enough evidence that he's not exactly who he used to be. And there may need to be some offseason work to kind of get back to where he used to be.
Command can come and go with Hader. I mean, I think in previous stints when he looked hittable, to me, it was hitters just sitting fastball, waiting for one and kind of getting lucky, guessing fastball up in the zone, tomahawking a 98-mile-an-hour fastball out for a homer, and that was sort of the downside. And now it seems like he is fighting those mechanics a bit more often. Also seems like the Giants might have something figured out with him, because it was the Giants on Tuesday night, and it was the Giants that hung 6 runs on Josh Hader back in the late part of July or mid part of July, right before the All-Star break, and it was one of the worst high-leverage relief performances ever in baseball history, just in terms of the disastrous nature of that outing.
One of the things the Giants do, thanks to Donnie Acker, who's moved on with the Rangers, that not every team does yet. This is teams are catching on to this, but you know, I was talking to Kristen Walker with the D-backs, and he trains this way. But what the Giants do is train for that specific night's pitcher with the machine, but also kind of turn it up. So they will face a Josh Hader before they face Josh Hader, but they will face a Josh Hader at 99 and 101. So that when they get in the game, Josh Hader himself, with that same movement profile, seems more hittable. And so maybe it's about that deception. Deception is a cool thing. It's a great thing. Teams are finding ways to go and get it. The Twins in particular seem to really value deception, and they've gotten guys that have it. But I think deception can go away over time because they see you. And if they train this way where their machine is very good at replicating your movement and replicating your sort of movement-based deception, then they can say, oh, I just faced Hader downstairs, you know, and he was 101 down there. So, you know, I got this. So I don't know. I think new training styles can kind of, and I know that's something that the Giants do a little bit differently than some of the teams.
Yeah, it's just interesting because this seems correctable overall, the release point issues that Hader's having. It's just a question of whether or not it can be fixed on the fly in season or if that is more of an off-season retooling, as you suggested. Let's shift the focus over to some injuries on the AL side. A big one for the White Sox. Katie, Tim Anderson down 4 to 6 weeks with a hand injury. And I think the White Sox depth has been a lingering question going back to last season. It felt like they were better going into 2022 than they were going to 2021. And after mostly sitting out the trade deadline along with the Guardians, I'm beginning to wonder if this team is actually good enough to hold its own. If they make it to the postseason, can they compete with the Yankees, the Astros, or even the Mariners and the Blue Jays at this point?
No, I think the Chicago White Sox have been an interesting storyline all season long because they were projected by a long shot to win the AL Central. I mean, this AL Central was supposed to be the least competitive division in baseball. And while the records would say they're not all that competitive, when you look at where they are, their top three teams in the Guardians, the Twins, and the White Sox, well, that's a pretty competitive division. I mean, right now, coming into play on Wednesday, White Sox are a game and a half behind both the Guardians and Minnesota atop that division. Now, the Tim Anderson injury is brutal. It seems like week after week, there's been something new about the White Sox where you just think, man, they really can't catch a break. And that is certainly where they stand the second week of August. It makes what they didn't do at the deadline a little bit more intriguing. Now, you look at the American League and you look at the Yankees in Houston, currently tied for the best records in that league, and you think, well, that's pretty clear cut. There is a clear drop down in talent. And I know the Yankees are scuffling a little bit right now. The Matt Carpenter news, that is brutal. I mean, you talk about such a success story, an inspiring story, comes back and then plays a huge part, a critical part in the success of their offense. And then I think we kind of discredit Toronto a little bit because they do play in the AL East, which is filled with teams that are competitive, and Seattle. Same thing. You know, they're a little bit overshadowed because Houston has been so good. I don't know if anyone that wins the AL Central can compete with those four teams. I don't think it's just a White Sox problem. I don't know if any of those. I mean, you can always argue you can get hot at the right time, and that's ultimately what the postseason is about. It's who gets hot after playing 162 games. Kind of unfair when you think about it. But I'm not sure the White Sox have the depth to be a playoff force going into October. They'll certainly find out with Anderson done for a little bit on how much depth they can rely on. But this is just a team that has had nothing really go their way, and it's going to have to fight just to win the division or even find a playoff spot. So the way it stands right now, no, I don't think the White Sox, or really, you can argue maybe the Guardians or Minnesota can go in there and put up a fighting chance, but the White Sox are certainly behind the eight ball, and they're going to have to do a lot over the next 8 weeks to kind of push themselves into that conversation.
Yeah, you know, depth is it's an interesting way to go, because, you know, I think when people think about teams, they think about the stars, you know. And if you think about the White Sox, I think you think of stars that can compete, especially if Giolito gets right again. You say, oh, you know, Cease, Giolito, you know, Hendricks, you know, think of their center field. You know, like, there's a lot of really good pieces there, Abreu. But you do look at the depth, and a team like the Astros just really outclasses them when you look at the bottom of the lineup or the guys that are going to step in when somebody's hurt. And it's kind of ironic, because I think that the few things that the White Sox did this past offseason were based on depth. AJ Pollock, trading for AJ Pollock was depth, you know, in the lineup versus depth in the bullpen. Josh Harrison and Lurie Garcia were signings that they made this offseason. Lurie Garcia right now is 57% worse than league average with the bat and below a win below replacement. AJ Pollock is having maybe his worst season of his career and is below replacement. Josh Harrison has been okay. He's been a pretty good signing for them. He's actually turned into their starting second baseman. He's no longer kind of a depth piece for them. So, you know, it's an interesting team there. And when I look at them, I think that, you know, unless Giolito and Lynn and Cueto and Kopech, like, you know, they've been up and down. I think if those guys can just turn into monsters, and they've had times in their career that are like that, then maybe they can be a different team than we thought. We thought this team would slug with anybody, you know. But if those four, you know, starters other than Cease can kind of match his energy level and just pitch lights out, then maybe they can bang with some people and have some low-scoring games. But that's not the White Sox we thought they were. And honestly, the Astros make contact. I think they're the best team in baseball when it comes to strikeout rate. You know, even if you do come into Houston for a postseason series and those four starters had been pitching well, the Astros will find a way to string together hits and walks and use their depth. Even though you think star by star, you know, the White Sox can match the Astros. So I think I agree with you. It'd be really important to win this division. I think it's almost the same as the NL Central. You might be a division winner, and the second place team in that division is like four or five games out of the wild card position. So it's going to be a scramble between three pretty flawed teams. The Guardians didn't do much to get better and just released from Reyes. Was supposed to be their biggest power threat coming into the season. So very interesting team. The Twins did the most at the deadline, and so I kind of expect them to come out of the fray. You know, it's a really good bullpen there. They can piece together the starting rotation, and I think they do have the depth that the White Sox lack.
Yeah, and I think the Twins' offense has been underrated. 10% better than league average as a team so far. That's sixth. I mean, they're right behind the Astros, just ahead of the Cardinals, just ahead of Atlanta, just ahead of Milwaukee, just ahead of Seattle. Those are all playoff-caliber teams, and they're right there ahead of many of them, only behind the Yankees, Dodgers, Mets, Jays, and Astros in terms of overall offensive performance. That is not where I thought the Twins would be at the beginning of the season. I think the White Sox are in real trouble. I actually like Cleveland more than I like the White Sox right now, because the one thing Cleveland has, since they didn't make moves at the deadline, they have all of their prospects, and many of their prospects are at AA and above, so they can start to bring those players up. Maybe they could follow the model from Atlanta and say, you know what, we've got some 21-year-olds that are actually ready to contribute. Let's just see what we can do, if we can make our roster better with players who are going to be here for the long haul. The White Sox don't have that luxury to fall back on right now, too, so I think that's another key difference as they try and battle it out for the division. The Chris Sale injury kind of popped up on Tuesday morning. He was in a bicycle accident and suffered a wrist injury to his non-pitching wrist. So I guess from a long-term perspective, a little less concerned given that it was the non-pitching wrist. But is this the last push that really kind of keeps the Red Sox from making the playoffs this year, Katie? This seems like a Red Sox team that is really in a pretty bad, almost two-month-long funk after it looked earlier this season like they were a pretty clear playoff team.
Yeah, when you look at the American League East, you look at one division where you cannot afford to get into a funk for more than a couple of weeks, let alone a couple of months. It's hard. I feel like there's some similarities between the Red Sox and the White Sox as far as expectations and then injuries and overall just a lack of consistent play. I also wasn't quite sure what Boston was doing at the deadline. I mean, were they buyers? Were they sellers? Were they something in between? You look at the AL East and you're looking at three teams that are going to play for the wild card, essentially. You know, you're looking at Toronto's going to be in there, the Rays. And at this point, we should be talking about the Orioles because they are right in there. And I just don't see Boston overcoming their first half struggles. And when you think about morale in August and how that carries into September, it just looks like the Red Sox are scuffling a little bit. So I think the Chris Sale news is just another thing to add up into what has just been a disappointing 2022 season for Boston. And they're going to have to, you know, go back to the drawing board and reiterate what is important. How can they continue progressing? What went wrong? What needs to go right? It's a really unfortunate injury for Sale. I ride my bike all the time, knock on wood. Haven't really had any, you know, severe accidents like that. It wasn't like it was a Madison Bumgarner or Fernando Tatis incident either. It was just a straight up bicycle, unless I'm misreading things. So just really unfortunate to me, pretty symbolic on how the Red Sox season has gone so far.
Do you ever wish you could have something both ways? A zero calorie cheeseburger, red wine with no headache, new baseball uniforms that aren't see-through. Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but you can have both with Mack Weldon's timeless apparel with performance fabrics. I just got Mack Weldon's silver crew neck tee in a couple of different colors in the silver peak polo. They're awesome. They look fantastic, but more importantly, they're the most comfortable shirts I've ever worn, and that's important. They're nice enough that I wear them to work, but so comfortable that they're a go-to on the weekends too. It's not flashy, just classic, always in style clothing made with performance materials, but those materials don't give their clothing that techie, shiny look that you see a lot of the time. They also have shorts, sweats, and warmer weather fleeces and button-up shirts, all the things you need any season of the year. Don't take my word for it, though. Try it yourself. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com and the promo code MLBSHOW.
Did you drop that question about whether or not they're gonna? What was the question that's in the rundown?
Yeah, which team finishes with more wins, the Red Sox or the Orioles? I keep waiting for the Orioles fade, and it's at least held off long enough to now we can ask this question on the 10th of August. Orioles are 58-52 entering play on Wednesday. Red Sox 54-57. So if you had to make the call right now, you know I'll go to you first. Who finishes with more wins at the end of the regular season between those two clubs?
Well, you know, I'm our resident nerd, and so I did look at the projected final records according to FanGraphs, and it's 80-82 for both of them.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I can't even.
FanGraphs isn't going to bail you out this time.
I can't default to the
heat up that waffle iron.
I gotta just do a straight take, you know, from the seat of my pants. I'm gonna go with the Orioles just because I don't think that narrative is powerful enough to take a terrible team and make it good. But when you're talking about two teams that are projected the same, the narrative around the Orioles is, hey, look at us, we're surprisingly good, you know? And that's just a more positive work environment. That's just a more positive feeling when you go to the office, basically, you know? And so instead of things kind of being like, oh no, here we go again, you know, it's going to be like, ah, don't worry about it. We got Felix Bautista. He's going to come in and clean this guy up. Oh, I walked the bases loaded in the ninth. Ah, whatever. Here comes, you know, Dylan Tate. He's going to get a ground ball double play and get us out of here. So, you know, they have some good pieces. They feel good. They have guys that they might call up. They have the number one prospect in baseball at shortstop. Maybe they decide to give him a look, you know. And the Red Sox, on the other hand, their center fielder of the future, everyone's mad at him. You know, he's like dropping balls and doesn't even look like he's trying to get them. And he's yelling at people in the stands. And looking super emotional, and like that just seems to me like a kind of microcosm. Now maybe Kike Hernandez, he's going on rehab. Maybe he can come back. He's a veteran presence. Maybe he can sort of solidify things. You know, Pham and Hosmer. Although I love Tommy Pham, but like looking to Tommy Pham to like settle things down.
Yeah, I mean, given the events that have played out over the course of just this year, that does seem like an unusual choice.
So I'm gonna go with the Orioles, man.
All right, Katie.
I'm gonna second that because for as the same narrative that Eno said, the Orioles are like, hey, look at us, we're surprisingly good, and the Red Sox are like, hey, look at us, we're surprisingly bad. What's going on? When you look at the Orioles, you look, it's really hard to continuously develop homegrown talent and push for a full rebuild and captivate the fans' attention at the same time. You have Adley Rutschman, who is just, I think, going to be a focal point of this Orioles for years to come. Ryan Mountcastle, you look at the young guys that they have, that they've developed as homegrown talent. That's really exciting. This is an Orioles team that did sell at the deadline and still find ways to keep winning games. You're looking at the Red Sox, and again, very unclear with what they were trying to do there. Yeah, they got Hosmer by default, only because he said no to Washington. They weren't really looking to trade for him. And then you look at where they stand, again, with their injuries, and you look at where the Orioles, and they're a little bit ahead of schedule. I mean, no one was expecting the Orioles. I mean, I can't even fathom that we're talking about the Orioles being in semi-postseason contention on, what, August 10th? So I do think, no, like vibes alone, that's not going to propel your win or loss. But overall morale, when you look at two teams trending in opposite directions, I'm always going to lean on the side where things seem to be going better. And in this case, it's very obvious, Baltimore.
I played soccer up through high school, and I was not the most physical player. I was unlikely to get carded for like a studs up tackle, but I was likely to be carded for dissent. And I will lean into that part of my personality here. I'm going to say the Red Sox do end up with more wins than the Orioles, in part because the Orioles actually have one of the most difficult schedules remaining this season.
Oh, a stat-based argument.
AL teams, they have the hardest schedule. I think they're fourth or fifth in terms of all of Major League Baseball. It's just a tough road for them. I don't really worry about the players they traded away because I think Trey Mancini kind of came from an area of depth. They have plenty of power on the corners. They're fine there. They seem to have a skill for finding and developing relievers now, which is huge. So you trade away Jorge Lopez, and you know, it's not like the Hader situation where he's been the guy for so long that it has this terrible ripple effect in the clubhouse.
And they love Felix Bautista in that clubhouse.
Yeah, they're kind of fine despite trading one popular player and one other guy that I think they liked, but just felt they could get some good long-term value for because his value might have been at a relative peak. But I think the key for me, even though things are really going wrong for Boston, even though the sky is falling, I think they played the middle because they believed in the event that everyone got healthy, and clearly that's not happening with the Sale accident, that they were good enough if they got to the playoffs to hold their own against the top teams in the American League. And I don't think that was necessarily flawed thinking, but I also think there was enough uncertainty about making the playoffs in the first place that mortgaging parts of the future to win now was pretty risky. So it's a little bit of a defense of Chaim Bloom for kind of playing the middle. They threaded the needle in a way that I think made sense because of all the injuries they were dealing with.
Yeah.
I think it was actually justified.
Because at the time, they could have thought, you know, Sale, Eovaldi could still be a top two, you know, in the postseason, and we have an okay lineup if everybody's actually hitting.
Right. Trading away J.D. Martinez, you know, trading Nathan Eovaldi, like punting like that was probably unnecessary given where they were at the deadline. So I think Boston finishes with just a few more, like 1 to 2 more wins than the Orioles, which I mean, I think I picked the Red Sox to win the division back at the beginning of the season. That's a terrible prediction right now. That's not happening. But I'll be the lone person here on the side of the Red Sox.
Long term, I kind of wonder if the Red Sox are missing Brian Bannister a little bit. He moved to the Giants. When I look at their plan, it's similar to the Rays, which is develop pitching and then sign veterans to one-year contracts. And in fact, they sign guys that the Rays signed before in Rich Hill and Michael Wacha. And I guess they got, you know, a win above replacement, you know, from each of those guys and some good stretches, about 140 good innings out of them. But, you know, kind of marrying that process with bringing up guys from the minors hasn't worked completely yet, you know? So, and then I had hopes for Tanner Houck being a starter. I don't know if they're giving up too early on him being a starter or if he's going to be a great reliever instead. But, you know, I kind of would have hoped for them to have an internal win that's better than Nick Pivetta at this point. And that's been sort of their high watermark so far. So if there's anything that I would look for in Boston, it was either in the pitching development department or maybe even in the park. And I know that there's some things that are impossible to change. However, that center field, you know, there are parts you can change about that park. And most other teams with really extreme park designs have made them more normal. I think that's true in St. Louis. I know it's true in San Diego, Seattle, San Francisco. And so I wonder if they're just dealing with it just being really difficult as a young pitcher to come up in Boston and pitch there. So I think those are valid questions. I don't know if there's an obvious answer to anyone listening, but those are the types of things I'd be thinking about in Boston in the offseason.
One last thing before we go. I think with the Orioles, the way you are both on them over the Red Sox, at least, makes me think they could be playing some meaningful games in September. They could be playing games where we're still talking about them as at least a contender for the last wild card spot, even if they're a few games back for most of the final month of the season. Does this put them in a position to be the breakout team of 2023? Could they be kind of how we feel about the Mariners right now, or depending on what moves follow in free agency or possible offseason trades? And you think about the young talent they've developed now. Gunnar Henderson has moved to the top of some prospect rankings over the course of the season. He's probably on the opening day roster in 2023. You know, Grayson Rodriguez has been hurt this year, but he's probably an impact starter for them next year. Colton Cowser is tearing up AA. DL Hall's not far away from contributing. The depth in this system has started to come through. A lot of guys have taken big steps forward in the organization. Are we willing to buy them at a level comparable to where the Mariners are at right now, looking to the future? And how optimistic are you about 2023 for the Orioles, Katie?
Well, again, I think it goes back to how difficult it is to develop homegrown talent throughout your farm system and really bank on that full rebuild. But if there's one team in baseball that gives me a little bit of confidence in their ability to do that, it is Baltimore. Again, they're going to be put. I don't think that the strength of the American League East is going anywhere come 2023. But I do think they'll be in a little bit of a comparable position there just based on the schedule and their opponents. But when you're looking at the rise of the Orioles, I don't think it's unrealistic to kind of compare them to the Seattle Mariners at this time next season. I do think that the Orioles have a lot of potential. They have a lot of young, moldable, formidable talent that all the what strikes me about the Orioles farm system is the high ceilings, right? They don't have a lot of like talent where you go out there and you're like, okay, well, we know like we're going to get this. We're going to get solid whatever production. When you look at the Orioles farm system, you're looking at a bunch of guys where you think, okay, this is a guy that could be really good. This is a guy that really could be, that has a lot of potential and again, a high ceiling. So I do think they're going to be hindered a little bit by their competition just in the division, but it certainly looks like when you're looking at this full organization rebuild, I mean, that takes a lot of patience for fans to pull off and a lot of things going right for an organization. But when you look at the player development side of this, it looks like it's going in the right direction.
Yeah, you know, I think one thing I would do is there are some teams that provide caution along the way. The Tigers year this year, I think, shows you how, you know, kind of coming back from a hole and rebuilding with the sort of scorched earth policy that, you know, some teams have used can be difficult because you are trying to build not only the players that Katie's talking about, but you also need to have that organizational depth where you're not running out zeros at, you know, different parts of your lineup, because that's one thing that the Cardinals are amazing at. I think they just are always turning out quality big leaguers. You know, they never really have a guy that's out on the field where you're like, wow, what is that guy doing out there? You know what I mean? Like, that's always, it's, I call it like a no zeros approach. Like, and when you're rebuilding and you kind of do scorched earth, there are times when you're all zeros. And so you kind of have to build up to a point where you're 26 no zeros, and that can be difficult. And I think the Tigers, you know, they went and they bought some players, and they, you know, they look like they were ascendant. I think you can even look at the Padres and, you know, how, you know, they've lurched forward and they've gotten better and they've gotten better. And then if you look at the Padres now, they have two homegrown players on their roster. It's two relievers. You know, like, so, so, you know, by the time the Orioles are a great team, they may have one or two of these players that we're talking about right now. It may take that long. That's the only note of caution I have. But I do think the Mariners are an interesting, I think an interesting model here. I think the one thing that's missing that we haven't seen from Mike Elias yet is that sort of trader Jerry DePoto mentality, where he's willing to start trading away some of these young pieces to kind of gel, to get the right fit on the field, identify some place where they have surplus and move forward. The deals he made at the deadline were largely, I guess, surplus in the reliever thing, the Jorge Lopez trade, but also Trey Mancini, he's not under contract next year, so, you know, we'll trade him. Sort of deal. So I'm waiting to see a little bit more ingenuity from Mike Elias on the trading front and the free agent front. Like, I don't know, if we haven't seen much in terms of free agency in Baltimore. But if he can supplement those guys that are coming up, I'll give it more of a 2 to 3 year timeline, as excited as we are, just because I am staring at the Tigers' place in the schedule right in the standings right now.
Yeah, maybe 2024 is the real beginning of the multi-year playoff window for the Orioles, but a much more watchable team, an exciting team at this point, as they have hung around much longer than expected here in 2022. That's going to do it for this episode of the 3-0 Show. If you don't have a subscription to The Athletic, you can get one for just $1 a month for the first 6 months at theathletic.com/baseballshow. On Twitter, you can find Katie at Katie J. Wu. You can find Eno at Eno Saris. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. The Athletic Baseball Show returns on Friday.
And remember, 3, it's the magic number.